From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On TV, he's tough guy Hawk, the mysterious loner with the big gun. On stage, he's starting a new music opera about Malcolm X and a one-man show about Paul Robeson. Actor Avery Brooks talks about the different sides of his career on today's Fresh Air. Also today, poet and essayist John Haynes discusses his decades in the Alaskan wilderness. Rock historian Ed Ward makes the case that Austin, Texas, and not San Francisco, was the birthplace of the psychedelic music scene. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new biography of writer Graham Greene. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The House today cut nearly $2 billion from the Bush administration's request for Star Wars spending. The president had proposed spending nearly $5 billion for the program next year. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater today brushed aside questions of a possible veto if the final version of the defense budget retains the House-approved cut. The sponsors of two controversial art exhibits would be prevented from receiving federal funds for the next 5 years. The ban was included in a measure approved today by the Senate Appropriations Committee. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
The two organizations singled out today by the Senate committee are the Institute for Contemporary Art in Philadelphia and the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art in Winston-Salem. The Institute in Philadelphia sponsored a retrospective of the works of the late photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, which included pictures with homoerotic and sadomasochistic themes. The Southeastern Center sponsored a show that included a photograph by Andres Serrano of a crucifix immersed in urine. Both of these exhibits were partially supported by funds from the National Endowment for the Arts. A couple of weeks ago, the House of Representatives voted to cut the budget of the NEA by the precise amount of money that it had given to support these two exhibits. Today, the Senate committee voted a similar cut, adding the 5-year ban on NEA funds for the two museums. Hugh Southern, the acting chairman of the NEA, called this a dangerous precedent. The measure goes to the full Senate tomorrow. I'm Ina Jaffe reporting.
A federal jury in Charlotte, North Carolina, has convicted two former assistants of PTL founder Jim Baker on charges of tax evasion. Ellie Boudreau of member station WFAE reports.
David and James Taggart were found guilty today on all counts of failing to pay more than $500,000 in federal income taxes. The prosecution charged that the brothers took money from PTL in the form of cash advances and liberal use of the ministry's credit cards. They then spent the money on luxury items for themselves and their friends and did not report it as personal income. The brothers maintain that Jim Baker himself authorized the $1.2 million they received between 1984 and 1987, and that PTL, not they, should pay whatever taxes are due. The Taggarts could each get up to 25 years in prison and $1 million in fines. Their sentencing hearing is scheduled for August 25th. That's just 3 days before Baker's trial begins. For National Public Radio, I'm Ellie Boudreau in Charlotte.
Samuel Pierce will get more time to prepare for his return to Capitol Hill to testify about his role in the fraud scandal at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The former HUD secretary had been scheduled to testify next week. The House Government Operations Subcommittee postponed testimony until September. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell today almost 2 points. This is NPR News. After a 3-day break, contract talks between the United Mine Workers Union and the Pittston Coal Group resumed this afternoon in southwest Virginia. Chris Roberts of member station WVTF in Roanoke reports the union returned to the bargaining table without its chief negotiator.
UMW Vice President Cecil Roberts, who has led the union's negotiating team since the strike began April 5th, was arrested this morning for staging a sit-in at the entrance to Pittston's Moss No. 3 coal preparation plant. Roberts and 18 other miners were charged by state police with obstructing traffic and were processed this afternoon in Honaker, Virginia. Roberts said he was protesting the unfair treatment the union has received from local officials. His action issues a direct challenge to Virginia Circuit Judge Donald McLaughlin, who has already fined the union more than $2 million for organizing sit-down demonstrations in front of Pittston operations. McLaughlin will decide on Thursday whether to levy more fines against the union for violating his injunction limiting the number of pickets in front of Pittston facilities. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Roberts in Roanoke.
Independence activists in the capital of Soviet Georgia today struck the windows of the KGB headquarters with their fists and threw eggs at a statue of Soviet founder Vladimir Lenin. The protest in Tbilisi came as a general strike halted mass transit in the business district of Sukhumi, the capital of the Abkhazia enclave in Soviet Georgia. A survey of cardiologists released today shows that up to 3,000 patients may have died prematurely before a nationwide trial discovered that two drugs designed to prevent irregular heartbeats could actually cause heart attacks among some patients. The director of the cardiac research at University of Pennsylvania's Hospital in Philadelphia, Dr. Joel Morgenroth, said he arrived at the estimate of mortality after surveying 1,000 cardiologists to find out how many had prescribed the two medicines, Enkenide and Flecainide. I'm Frank Stachel, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. On TV, Avery Brooks is a tough guy. He played Hawk in the ABC detective series Spencer for Hire. Hawk was a mysterious, imposing character with a shaved head, dark glasses, and a big gun under his leather coat. Hawk always managed to intuitively show up in the nick of time to bail Robert Urich Spencer out of a jam. When Spencer went off the air, Avery Brooks got his own spin-off series, A Man Called Hawk. It was canceled last season after 13 episodes. But the work Brooks is perhaps most serious about is the work he's least known for, his roles on the stage. In 1985, he starred as Malcolm X in the new music opera X. He's performed on and off Broadway with the Negro Ensemble Company and the New York Shakespeare Festival. In 1983, he starred in the one-man show Paul Robeson, and last year he opened in that show on Broadway. He's also taken the show on the road, and it will run in Philadelphia throughout the month of August. I asked Avery Brooks about the influence Paul Robeson had on his life when he was growing up.
Well, as a boy, I mean, among other people, I was just studying the history, you see, so that certainly the music that was all around me. So people like Paul Robeson, William Warfield, Marian Anderson, I mean, all the great singers. I mean, indeed, Brooke Benton. I mean, I could go on and on. Billy Eckstein, I'm very familiar with him. So Paul Robeson is just logical in my growing up.
One of the songs that's most associated with Robeson is Old Man River, which he sang in Showboat. And I always thought of that song as such a kind of cliche type of song until I actually saw the 1936 movie with Robeson singing it. And It was such a really incredible performance.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, he had such power.
Well, what's your reaction to singing the song? I mean, how do you handle it? I assume it's in the show.
Well, you see, my father used to sing it as well.
Oh, really?
He says, so there's a kind of, I can not help but think about my father every time I start to sing it. You know, in the way my father used to hold his hands, etc. I mean, let alone thinking about Robeson. But I mean, when I think about it in terms of Robeson, it is certainly his signature. But also, I can't help but think about his politics, You see.
So. You said you were interested in Paul Robeson's politics. Now,
yes.
In 1978, when the show first was performed, it was criticized for trivializing Robeson. A petition was circulated that said, quote, "We regretfully feel compelled to take the extraordinary step of alerting all concerned citizens to what we believe to be, however unintended, a pernicious perversion of the essence of Paul Robeson." And that was signed by James Baldwin and Paul Robeson Jr., Maya Angelou, Julian Bond. And I think the reason for saying that was because in 1978, a lot of his politics were left out of the production. So what was your reaction to that criticism when you decided to take on the role?
Well, I didn't sign the petition either.
Uh-huh.
Indeed, were you asked to?
Oh,
no, not at all. I'm just saying I never signed it. In fact, I took my classes to see it. I mean, I think it's important that we reserve the right to celebrate the best of us without any kind of censorship at all. Indeed, the fact that Paul Robeson's memory has been virtually erased from the American scene, you know, it seems to cry, you know, I mean, very loudly for, you know, any information about him, you know, to celebrate him or to restore him so that when it came time for me to do it, I mean, when I was asked to do it, I didn't hesitate at all.
Well, I'd like to play you singing something that you sing in the show, but since I don't have a recording of that, let me play another recording that you're featured on, which is really a
really fine recording. This is from a few years ago, although I don't remember exactly the date. 1978, I guess.
There it is.
Okay. And this is from an album with flutist James Spaulding. It's an album of Ellington songs.
Yes.
And this is you singing Come Sunday.
Sun and moon up in the sky. I don't mind the gray skies, 'cause they're just clouds passing by.
Avery Brooks singing Come Sunday from an album recorded in 1978. And Avery Brooks is about to star again in a production of Paul Robeson. That production will be in Philadelphia. He also did the role on Broadway. And Avery Brooks is also probably known to you as Hawk from the series Spencer for Hire and the series A Man Called Hawk. Well, you come from really a long line of singers, or maybe not so long, but it seems like everyone in your immediate family sang.
Indeed.
See, your father was in the Wings Over
Jordan. Wings Over Jordan, that's right.
It was a gospel choir that had a show on CBS for a long time, CBS
that's
Radio.
Right.
Your mother was a church pianist, organist, and choir director?
Well, I mean, quite an extraordinary musician. I mean, she played piano, organ, was a choral conductor, played violin, guitar, you know, taught voice. Extraordinary lady.
And someone in your family was a member of the Delta Rhythm Boys?
The original Delta Rhythm Boys, as a matter of fact, my mother's brother, Travers. In fact, I was telling someone earlier today, my mother used to write their arrangements in 1936. I mean, that's when they left Dillard and based themselves in South America, indeed in Brazil. And my mother, wherever they went in the world, would write the arrangements on onion skin paper and mail them to them.
Oh, that's great.
It's an extraordinary story.
So there was no separation in your family between secular and gospel music? Both
oh,
were
not
perfectly
at all.
Acceptable.
Not at all. I mean, world music, you see.
And what music did you gravitate to yourself?
I gravitate to all music, actually. I mean, you know, the fact that we had such a wide exposure, you know, meant that we could not possibly limit ourselves. I mean, the fact of the matter is that that's what happened when I moved to theater. You know, and rather than limiting myself to calling myself an actor, I call myself a theater artist, and I still do, just as a musician should be able to play all music. And thus, as a theater artist, I think I should be able to do virtually anything.
Did you have trouble doing virtually anything? Was it hard to get the kinds of roles you wanted when you were starting out?
Well, I think it is important to know that, I mean, the opportunities in the historical of it are still not that, you know, abundant. For people of color, indeed, black male folk, for example, but that I knew very early that I must create the things for myself. So I've always been doing that rather than wait for someone to give it to me.
Did you ever have to sing? I mean, like so many black singers and actors get started in, you know, Porgy and Bess or productions of Godspell or something.
Fortunately,
cast.
I didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because I never listened. I guess that's probably what happened.
Listen,
you know,
to what kind of advice?
I never paid attention. I never paid attention to the voices that said I could not. As a matter of fact, I was compelled when someone said I could not. You know, it made me do more. You know, I just went on my own roads.
Well, you talk about creating opportunities for yourself, and you were, I think, good friends with many like new music composers and jazz composers, and you starred in a new music opera called X, which is an opera about Malcolm X,
yes.
written by Anthony Davis. And you first played the role of Street, which was the character that introduced Malcolm X to street life, to crime, to gambling.
Yes. And
you were really magnetic.
Ah, I didn't
role.
See it, but thank you very much.
And then you played Malcolm afterwards. Now, it was an operatic role. You're not a trained opera singer.
Exactly.
What were some of the difficulties for you in singing a role written as opera?
Well, I suppose the primary thing is projection. I mean, you have to have the chops, you know, to fill up, you know, the Metropolitan. I mean, that's really the deal. And you know, you just can't just pop into it unless you have this extraordinary gift like Sarah Vaughan. I mean, and there are singers who can just do anything at any time. But dig, that I was interested in singing the role of Malcolm X to point out, and well, I'll say it bluntly, to make other opera singers angry, you see, because rather than standing there and singing, you know, and letting the music just flow. I mean, there's life. When you talk about Malcolm X, there is life, there's movement, there are all of these other things, which I know how to do. And when people witness it, you know, to witness the whole of it rather than just experiencing the music, we have to experience all of the vitality and the energy, et cetera, of it. So, I mean, it was almost like a challenge. And I said this to Anthony Davis. I said, let me sing it. And they'll get mad because the first thing they'll say is that he can't sing opera, you dig? Like that. So that's how it really happened.
Actor Avery Brooks is my guest, and he's starred in an opera about Malcolm X. He's currently starring in a production of Paul Robeson, and you also know him as Hawk from the TV series Spencer for Hire and the spin-off series A Man Called Hawk. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Avery Brooks is my guest. Now, the story of how you ended up playing Malcolm X,
yes,
in the opera is a really incredible story. You were supposed to play X, right? Then you got the role of Hawk,
right,
on the series Spencer for Hire.
Right.
And the person who was going to play Malcolm X got sick and couldn't play the role. So you ended up flying back and forth between Boston and Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Playing both roles at the same time, basically.
Yeah.
Let me just go back a little bit. When you were slated to star in this opera, mm-hmm, but at the same time were offered this role to play Hawk, was it a tough decision to make? Because you knew you'd have to sacrifice
the role
in the opera.
As it happened, the possibility of the series was already in the works.
Oh, so you knew that this was a possibility.
It could have happened.
Yeah.
And so it did. I mean, the other thing about it is that I knew that I needed lots and lots of time to then, you know, really become the opera singer, you know, and I did not want to do any disservice to the work, you know, by trying to split time and holding the people, you know, mm-hmm, hostage for something that may or may not happen. But as it turned out, I ended up doing it anyway. So like that, it was, it didn't take much for me to do it. After all, it's Malcolm X. I mean, when one talks about courage, I mean, you know, Malcolm X exhibited extraordinary courage. Again, this notion of celebrating, you know, the culture of celebrating the great ones of us. I mean, the least that I can do is to give it some, you know, effort, you know, rather than shying away.
Had you auditioned for parts on TV before Hawk?
Of course. You know, I've been straddling the fence, I mean, between the academic and the professional for many, many years.
Uh-huh. What kind of roles did you go up for?
Whatever roles were available. I mean, it's not as if, you know, you can pick and choose. I mean, what's interesting about this thing, the Hawk thing, you very rarely get a chance to read the entire script, you know, I mean, when you audition. And those of us who audition, you know exactly what I mean. So you see sides. And this is another one of these things that people bother you about. It was raining, sleeting, snowing. You know, it was one of those days, and I'm going in for the audition. I'm saying, I'm not going to get this anyway. Why am I going in? You know what I mean? And they're bothering me again about it, but I did. And they called me back again, and I said to my wife, why are they bothering about this, huh? But it was one of these things that just happened. There's nothing extraordinary about the story. You know, there was nothing really spelled out in terms of the character. I mean, that's kind of classic. You know, again, in the historic, in the landscape of our history, that is, you know, that's very, very true. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that when people talk about black folk, indeed, or write about them, it's usually in some hieroglyphic fashion. I mean, it's kind of, you know, a kimosabi kind of language, et cetera, et cetera. Kind of embarrassing, actually. But so that, I mean, this is just another one of these things, I thought.
So when you got the role, did you want to make changes in the character?
Sure.
What kind of changes did you make from the way it was originally conceived?
Well, I looked at, you know, at this that kind of cryptic, you know, language, this language that that does not resonate in the culture.
Can you give me an example of a phrase? A
cryptic
phrase?
I would never do that. You know what I'm saying? To give away the writer's talent. But the fact of the matter is, as I said, well, this does not resonate, you know, in the culture. Nobody's going to believe, you know, this urban black male is going to talk like this. Nobody's going to believe it, let alone me. I have to go home, for example. And somebody's going. So I said, please change this. Can you? He said, no. You don't understand. Your responsibility is to hit your mark and say your lines. From that moment forward, I didn't ask another question. I did not make another comment. I created it all on the spot. When the camera rolled, I made it up.
So you made up the lines as it
happened? Yes.
Well, let me play you an example of some Hawk dialogue.
Fine.
And this is a scene from the series Spencer for Hire, which was, by the way, based on the Robert B. Parker, a detective novel series. So this is a sequence between Hawk, played by my guest Avery Brooks, and the detective Spencer, played by Robert Urich. And this is part where Hawk is kind of giving the lowdown on a killer, someone who's just tried to shoot Spencer.
Still looking. Did find out one thing about the shootee. He shall not be mourned by many.
Slade?
Good detective, bad man. Uses his detecting skills to find out nasty information about folk, then charges them large sums of money not to detect anymore.
Blackmail? Blackmail Laurie? Blackmail the Kincaids?
See, tired as you are, you still get that steel trap mine. You will convey my regrets to your blue suit friends. I have to find a man carrying my bullet in his body.
Lines like yours, like your blue suit friends, to refer to the police. Is that?
That's
that
exactly
yours?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, all these things. I mean, they're not particularly original. I mean, I'm quoting the culture, all the time. I mean, Hawk is the baddest cat I know. You know, because he's certainly a composite of all of these bad dudes who have gone before. I mean, you can find him virtually in every epoch, every age, every era, like that.
Now, I understand that you wouldn't let your children watch the shows because they were too violent.
Well, you
is that right? I read that. You can tell me if it's true.
In these past several days, people have been asking me about this. I mean, you know, there might seem to be a double standard. I mean, after all, lots of children, I'm sure, watch the show. I know they do. I mean, the fact of the matter is that my wife and I decided that, you know, until we had the time to sit down with them, you know, and explain to them exactly what I was doing, et cetera, et cetera. You know, then we won't let them watch it. We taped everything, so it's available to them. So, simply said, I decided, well, not now, later.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My guest is actor Avery Brooks, who has starred as Hawk in Spencer for Hire and in A Man Called Hawk. He starred as Malcolm X in an opera called X, and he's now starring in Paul Robeson, a role that he did on Broadway and is about to do in Philadelphia. When you got the spinoff series, A Man Called Hawk, after Spencer for Hire was canceled, was that a kind of demonstration of the fact that the Hawk character caught on more than the Spencer character?
I don't know. I mean, I will say this. What an attractive character Hawk is. I mean, there's something very appealing about someone who is precise, someone who is decisive, someone who seems to be able to act, you know, no matter what. You know, someone who is that clear and who goes and comes when he pleases. I mean, what a wonderful thing. A chance again for us, you know, to at once to be children again. You know what I mean? No fuzz around it.
You sound like you miss him.
I like Hawk.
Yeah.
I like Hawk as much as anybody else. Again, I told you he's the baddest cat I know. Fact of the matter is, I doubted whether, when they asked about this Hawk show, whether people were really serious, that is, the network and the studio, really serious about doing it. You know, I mean, presenting a contemporary brown mythological hero on primetime television. You see, In our first news conference, for example, in California, we had journalists from all over the country, you know, people had, a number of journalists had very strong feelings that that I could not I could not do this. But it was okay to have Superboy, you know what I'm saying? I mean, in the same breath, you dig what I'm saying? Or that I could not wear dark glasses at night. I mean, as if I was, you know, trying to be a clown or a buffoon. But Tom Mix never lost his hat in a fight. But you know what I'm saying? And the Lone Ranger wore a mask. I mean, we're talking about contemporary mythology. I mean, it is not innocuous either. It is very carefully plotted and manipulated and thought out. But, you know, why not? Is the point.
When you started A Man Called Hawk, the spin-off series, were there certain personal touches you wanted in there? Certain things that were just you that you wanted in?
Oh, of course, not just me. I mean, the music.
Okay.
I wanted to. That Hawk comes from the music. He is music. I mean, the way he walks. I mean, his dress. I mean, it's very, very musical. And so that I want music to be a character in the show. You know, as much as the city or whoever else was written, I mean, who had words. So I wanted the music to really play an important role in it. That was really the most important thing.
And you had a jazz composer, Butch Morris, doing all the music.
Oh, yeah, an extraordinary musician.
Not Morris, someone who's Butch gotten Morris. TV work before, I'm sure.
That's also the point. That's exactly the point.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to break the cycle or break the tradition. I mean, an extraordinary array of musicians. And to have these great musicians on primetime television was such an extraordinary moment for me.
And did you change the character of Hawk?
No. No reason to. If it's not broke, don't fix it.
Good. Okay. I find it kind of paradoxical that you've become most famous for this, action kind of role. And the background that you're from is a background that is of such kind of highly educated families. There are so many firsts in your families in terms of education. Your father graduated from Tougaloo in 1901.
My mother's father. Yes,
okay,
my grandfather,
in 1901 or something. And your mother was the first.
She was one of the
black graduate of Northwestern or something.
Well, yeah, she got her MFA. Yes, her master's in music, I should say. It wasn't MFA then. Master's in music, you know, I think circa 1938, you know, at a time when black people couldn't live on campus and nobody would even sit next to her in the classroom. But, I mean, she graduated summa cum laude, as a matter of fact.
Were your parents ever afraid of losing you to bad influences? Were they very protective of you?
Well, I mean, not any more than, you know, all parents are. I mean, and realizing, you know, to raise male children, I have an older brother. I mean, to confront that, even as I, you know, looked forward to having children, you know, I mean, the first thing that I said, you know, what am I going to tell my male children? You see what I mean? In a world, they're going to getting ready to grow into a world that is not particularly interested in them living a long life. I mean, that's fact. You know, I mean, the history bears that out. But, you know, it is an extraordinary worry when I think about what I'm going to tell even my youngest son, who is now 18 months old. What am I going to tell him about what it means to be brown and male and in America? So it doesn't go away. I guess it is by the grace of God that I suppose I'm here.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work and your life. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been actor Avery Brooks, and he's starring as Paul Robeson in the Philip Hayes Dean play. Paul Robeson is being staged in Philadelphia throughout the month of August. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Wayne Wang, the Chinese-American filmmaker. His film Chan is Missing gained critical and commercial success. He followed that up with Dim Sum and then Slam Dance. His new film is called Eat a Bowl of Tea. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When poet and essayist John Haynes moved to Alaska, it was still just a territory. In the decades since then, he's become one of the first to capture the voice of the American North. Coming up, the words of John Haynes. In the 1960s, San Francisco was the city at the heart of psychedelic music, but rock historian Ed Ward says psychedelic music really has its roots in Austin, Texas. And book critic John Leonard reviews Norman Sherry's new biography of writer Graham Greene. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. The House today voted to reduce the Pentagon's Star Wars program by nearly $2 billion, deciding instead to spend the money on conventional forces, nuclear cleanup, and the war on drugs. Details from NPR's Cokie Roberts.
The House of Representatives today voted to cut the administration's Star Wars request by almost $2 billion, cutting it below its current funding level. The vote came as Congress is looking for ways to cut back on defense spending in the face of large federal deficits and voter demands for more social spending. And while lobbying his former congressional colleagues on Capitol Hill today, Defense Secretary Richard Cheney conceded it's harder to get Congress to go along with big-ticket weapons systems at a time of greatly reduced tension with the Soviet Union. He insisted that arms control negotiations are dependent on some defense systems, particularly the B-2 stealth bomber. Despite that argument, the House is expected to give strong approval to cuts in the number of bombers to be produced and could even kill the program altogether. The Senate is hoping to head off that move by giving its support to the B-2 later this evening. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
The United Airlines pilot who brought down a badly damaged DC-10 for a crash landing in Sioux City, Iowa last week, spoke with reporters today about his efforts and those of the crew. More from Doug Johnson of member station KWIT.
Pilot Al C. Haynes says he and the crew improvised when they were told procedures don't exist for flying a DC-10 that's lost its hydraulic system. Haynes, co-pilot William Records, flight engineer Dudley Dvorak, and off-duty United pilot Denny Finch brought the plane down at the Sioux Gateway Airport. Haynes was called a hero last week for bringing down the crippled jet.
There is no hero. There is just a group of four people who did their job, and it was an unusual circumstance, but we put our best resources and knowledge together and did what we thought was best.
Of 296 passengers on board, 185 survived and 111 were killed. Investigators are still looking for a cause of the crash. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Johnson reporting in Sioux City, Iowa.
Former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Samuel Pierce's second appearance before a House panel investigating the department has been postponed. Pierce was scheduled to testify next week, but he requested an extension, saying he needed more time to prepare for the hearing. The House Government Operations Subcommittee on Employment and Housing has postponed Pierce's testimony until mid-September. Pierce will face questions about his role in HUD's approval of more than $15 million in grants and subsidies for a North Carolina project that was supported by a former law partner of Pierce's. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 1.90 points today. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Nowadays, the Vulcan Gas Company is the name of a video rental outfit in Austin, Texas. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says back in the late 60s, the Vulcan Gas Company was one of the first places to stage psychedelic concerts.
Although I live in Austin, Texas, I'm not one of those Texans who has to brag on the state all the time. But the historian in me insists on making something absolutely clear. The whole 60s psychedelic ballroom scene with those blobby liquid projection light shows was not invented in San Francisco, no matter what California chauvinists might say. That scene, as well as a lot of the bands that played it, started just a few blocks from my house here in Austin, and among its pioneers was my neighbor across the street, Houston White. The story starts sometime in 1966, Powell St. John, a jeweler, harmonica player, and songwriter, had a band named after a powerful hoodoo charm, St. John the Conqueror. Powell St. John, though, left Austin at the end of the year, following his friend Janis Joplin, whom University of Texas students with characteristic compassion had just voted ugliest man on campus. But the band was good, Bob Brown replaced Powell, and they kept playing. Like most bands of the time, their repertoire was mostly blues and whatever pop songs would give them space for long guitar solos, which was lucky because the Conqueror, as they now called themselves, had a great guitarist in Charlie Pritchard. What they didn't have, though, was a place to play. It all came together at Doris Miller Auditorium in the early summer of 1967 in the heart of Austin's Black East Side. The Conqueror opened the show for a band from nearby San Marcos, the 13th Floor Elevators. The show drew a lot more people than the hall would hold. As it happened, though, a young artist named Jim Franklin had been walking downtown that very afternoon and had found a property for rent at 316 Congress between the prestigious Crest Hotel and the State Capitol building. He alerted two of the guys in the light show, Houston White and Gary Scanlon, and they told the guy doing the sound, Sandy Lockett, and then they alerted another artist, Gilbert Shelton. A hall had been found, and it was right downtown. Shelton painted the storefront and the logo. Everybody worked on cleaning the place out, and in October 1967, the Vulcan Gas Company opened with the Conqueror as house band. Well, I've got a feeling, baby, that I'm just a passenger in your love. Just a quiet voyager in your heart. Just a lonely ride. The Vulcan, as it was called, was an instant hit. Among other things, it gave touring bands a place to play, and Canned Heat, Moby Grape, and the Velvet Underground were happy to stop off in Austin's psychedelic oasis on their way from coast to coast. The Velvets even recorded a live album there in 1969. But it was the local talent that was thriving because of the visitors. Shiva's Headband, for instance, featured the electric violin of Spencer Perskin and was capable of playing psychedelic country music, something they really didn't do much of at first because it would have identified them with the anti-Vulcan crowd. But the guy who really put the Vulcan on the map was a cross-eyed albino from Beaumont, Texas, whose live album, cut there in 1968, brought him to the attention of Rolling Stone, who dubbed Johnny Winter the next big thing. Now my mother, she done told me, and my father done told me. Sorry. But by the time Winter put out his first record for Columbia in 1970, the Vulcan was a memory, closed down, its originators scattered from New Mexico to California. Sharp listeners will have noticed that I said the ballroom scene started in Austin, but the Vulcan didn't open until 1967. True, but the ballroom scene in San Francisco started with a Texan who'd observed Austin's Jomo Disaster light show, Chet Helms. He wound up managing the Conqueror after they moved to San Francisco in 1968. They quickly broke up, but in an odd sidelight, Charlie Pritchard and Houston White are pretty famous faces, thanks to Vulcan artist Gilbert Shelton. They live on in the underground comics as two-thirds of the Furry Freak Brothers, Houston as Free Will and Frank, and Charlie as Fat Freddy.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. From the day my guest John Haynes set foot in Alaska, he said he knew he was home. It was just after World War II, and as Haynes would write later, something in me identified with that landscape. I had come, let's say, to the dream place. Haynes is one of Alaska's best-known and most acclaimed writers. His poems and essays about living off the land and the Alaskan wilderness have won the praise of other nature writers, such as Barry Lopez, who says that Haynes has kept a vigil on the frontier where most of us, I suspect, would have finally run out of patience, done in by the loneliness. When Haynes built his cabin in Richardson, 60 miles from Fairbanks, he had to hunt moose to keep from going hungry. But now he has a good car and can drive 30 miles to the grocery. For the past few years, he's only lived in his cabin part-time. Haynes has written a memoir called The Stars, The Snow, The Fire. I asked him to read an excerpt.
The wilderness is open, and whoever enters it knows the satisfaction of being at ease in a country he calls his own. The land belongs to him and to no one else. He can go where he likes, following his own trail through the spruce bogs and across the dry birch hills, a pathway tramped in the snow, to stop at nightfall in his own snug camp.
What first brought you to Alaska?
The end of World War II, in part, the fact that I was at loose end, so to speak, and out of the Navy, and the Alaska Highway had just opened up to civilian travel, and there was a lot of news in the papers about people going north to Homestead. And I might not have done it at that particular time if it had not been for the fact that as a friend of mine had discussed going up there with someone else, and they asked me to join them. And everything sort of led from that. And long before that, I had, as a boy, I'd urged to go into the woods someplace and make a home. I didn't connect it with Alaska, but that's the way it turned out to be.
Well, you did homestead, and you built a cabin in Richardson, Alaska. What did it take to homestead, to get the land that you built the cabin on?
Well, in those days, Alaska was not a state, as you may know. It was a territory. And most of the land here was federally owned, and it meant that you could go almost anywhere. I mean, anywhere outside of a town, as long as it was not an Indian reservation, and take up a piece of land and live on it. Any amount of land, for one reason or other, could be obtained that way. And I just found a piece that I liked, as I said, near Richardson, and filed on it and got patent for it some years later.
It seems to me that there's at least two things that have attracted you to Alaska. One is the sense of living on the frontier, but the other is the solitude that it affords. What is it in you that needs that kind of solitude?
Well, I've always had an ambivalent attitude towards solitude. On the one hand, needing it for certain reasons, and on the other, not feeling entirely comfortable with it. I mean, I have a gregarious side to me. I enjoy people. But I think the fundamental solitude was necessary in order for me to learn certain things that I could not have learned any other way. And as I said in one of the essays in The Stars, There's No Fire, that there's just something about a certain kind of life that you can only learn by plunging into it and killing animals and dealing in blood and things of that sort. And there's no other way to do it. You can't do it by sitting in an office somewhere and imagining it.
What are some of the things you think you've learned by living alone in the wilderness and having to hunt for your own food?
Well, I think I learned something essential about living in a certain place. I think that this was a very good lesson for me, and I've tried to explain that in essays here and there, that something essential in human life is approached in that way. And anybody who farms and plants and tends animals will understand what I mean. It's a life that goes back to a very early time in human history. And I think periodically some of us at least, and perhaps humanity itself, needs to return some distance in that direction and to relearn these lessons. And certainly individually, some of us are, for one reason or another, led to do that. And that's essentially what it was about.
Do you ever lose track of the days?
Nope. Yes. Yes, I lose track of a lot of things, but not usually the days, no. I don't listen to the radio. I get enough bad news in the newspapers, and but I have, you know, I pay attention to that. Yeah.
You say that you were born as a poet in Alaska, that you started writing poetry while living there. How did you start writing in Alaska?
I started writing, I say seriously, the first winter I spent at the cabin of Richardson. And the reason I started writing is rather mysterious, but I had been studying art, painting and sculpture back east before I came to Alaska. And I assumed that when winter shut down that I would get my paints out and set up easel and canvas and paint. And I discovered I wasn't going to be able to do that for any number of reasons, lack of light. But I needed some way of responding to the experience, you see. And so I began writing. I didn't know quite what I was writing or what I was going to do with it, but I knew enough about poetry, for example. And that's how it started. I had to get something down. I had to find some way to express my feeling about things and my reaction to the country and simply being there.
Can I ask you to read a short poem for us of yours?
Yeah, I will do that. And I'll read something out of the first book, Winter News, and it just is a brief, I would say, a description or a presentation of a certain mood inside the house and at the end of a day, and in the fall, obviously, and winter is coming on, and there's a certain quietness into things, and certain things have been done and accomplished, and you have a sense of the year drawing toward an end. And it's a kind of dying away of things. The leaves have fallen, winter is coming on, and you have this sense of a certain finality. And that's mainly what's in the poem. Listening in October. In the quiet house, a lamp is burning, but the book of autumn lies open on a table. There is tea with milk in heavy mugs, brown raisin cake, and thoughts that stir the heart with the promises of death. We sit without words, gazing past the limit of fire into the towering darkness. There are silences so deep, you can hear the journeys of the soul, enormous footsteps downward in the breezing earth.
In a previous book of yours, you mentioned that to find a literature of the North, you had to look to the literature of other countries because the far North really hasn't been part of the American consciousness.
Right. I would say that, yeah.
Do you think that writers such as yourself now living in Alaska will change that in some way?
Well, I think that I have, to some extent, initiated something of that sort. I suppose I could claim that some of my poems, not all of them, because I've written poems about many, many other things, but at least the first poem that I published in book form did present something new, and it has been called the first serious poems of the far north in American literature, and maybe that's true and maybe it isn't, but I think it's a fair guess. Other people have been since writing and adding to it in some way, but as I say, I think this is, we're still very much at the beginning of what I would call a serious literature from this part of the world.
Frontiers, especially last frontiers like Alaska, become very symbolic in a lot of people's minds, and to some people who go there, they're seeking some transformation that they can't find where they are. They're kind of at the place of last resort, and I think I've run into a lot of drifters and losers who think that their fate's going to change when they get there, when they get to Alaska. And I wonder if you've run into a lot of people like that yourself.
Yeah, I'd say that there were quite a few dead-enders here in Alaska, as you find them elsewhere. But it's the illusion of, you know, the last place to go. And, I mean, the last frontier is a cliché, in a sense, and in another sense, it's a very real thing. But it attracts all kinds of people, good and not so good. But for one reason or another, I think people come here often. They do find something of themselves, if nothing else. But it is a place where you you tend to meet up with certain things in yourself, or simply in the world around you that are not always easy to face, to understand, and to make sense of, and make some good use of.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for your patience, and I hope I've said something worth listening to.
John Haynes' memoir, The Stars, the Snow, the Fire, is published by Gray Wolf Press. He spoke to us from station KUAC in Fairbanks. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we're going to talk about coal and steel this evening. The president has extended the quotas on imported steel to continue the protection of the American steel industry for another 2.5 years. And we're going to look at the Pittston Company. That's the company that is having such difficulty reaching agreement with the United Mine Workers. It's been a very prolonged and difficult strike. And we're going to take a look at three parliaments in Poland, in Britain, and in India, where there are difficulties and disturbances and upheavals going on in all three.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The first 35 years of British novelist Graham Greene's life is the subject of Volume 1 of a new biography by Norman Sherry. This is the period before Greene wrote his best-known books, Our Man in Havana, Honorary Counsel, and The Quiet American. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
You know you're in for it when you're told on page 9, knowledge of death came early to Graham Greene. After 5 books on Joseph Conrad, Norman Sherry was Graham Greene's hand-picked choice to write his biography. Greene, of course, is obsessed with Conrad, and Sherry had made it a point to go everywhere in the world that Conrad went before committing him to paper. Perhaps the globe-trotting Greene sought sadistically to punish anyone seeking to improve on his own too elegant and evasive memoirs, A Sort of Life and Ways of Escape. Or maybe he thought that his secrets of character were safe from any mind as simple as Sherry's, and that a dose of the biographer's porky prose would drive all readers back to the original. Anyway, here is Volume 1 of Sherry, all 783 pages of it. It drags us gasping and petulant up to 1939, before the important novels were written, only half a century to go. And the reviews I've seen so far verge on the worshipful, and I'm mystified. Going everywhere a writer's gone, to Liberia and Mexico, to Haiti, Argentina, Paraguay, and Panama, to Antwerp and Indochina, is no substitute for thinking about what the writer's written, why he wrote it that way, and what he left out because of art, or guilt, or cussedness. It's the wrong kind of archaeological digging. Richard Ellman didn't take time off for sodomy before writing of Oscar Wilde, nor have any biographers of Dostoevsky submitted to epileptic seizure. That Greene's childhood was unhappy isn't news. Except for Updike and Nabokov, all writers seem to have been sad when small. That he crossed psychological borders as well as national frontiers has been a staple of Greene criticism for three decades, as have his fixation on betrayal, his nose for spiritual decay, and his trafficking with prostitutes. And Sherry doesn't fare much better down in the archives. If we are to spend so much time inspecting the exchange of insipid letters between a callow Greene, then an editor at the Times of London, and Vivian Dayrell Browning, the sexually fearful young woman he would marry, shouldn't Sherry at least wonder whether the famous conversion to Roman Catholicism hadn't more to do with going to bed than finding God? He might also have wondered if there might not have been, right at the beginning of Greene's career, a fateful confusion of Eros and Grace. Along the same lines, Sherry makes much of the young Graham's psychoanalysis and subsequent and drastic change of personality. This material cries out for development and comparison and cross-reference with other writers who've been analyzed. But Sherry's on a boat or in a jungle. Greene's analyst happened to have been a Jungian. A biographer with a sense of humor might at least have speculated on the consequences for literature had the analyst been a Freudian or a Reichian or a Sullivanian. I began a list of Greene's dreams, as reported here, of empty cupboards and witches with white puffy hands and fleshy faces, of the Princess of Time with black-skinned servant girls whose touch was death, of slashed throats and murderous Chinese agents and old women with ringworm, of murdering J.B. Priestley and the President of Liberia. And then I had the worst dream of all myself, that all of his books should disappear, and we'd have to imagine Graham Greene from the lumpy pudding of his biographer.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Volume 1 of The Life of Graham Greene by Norman Sherry. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet today's foremost Chinese-American filmmaker, Wayne Wang. He directed Chan Is Missing, Dim Sum, Slam Dance, and the new film, Eat a Bowl of Tea. Also, we review a new edition of a novel from the 1920s that deals with many of the issues of contemporary feminism. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.